This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama intensifies the war on auto workers. At a White House press conference at the end of March, President Barack Obama outlined his administration's plan to drastically downsize the U.S. auto industry. He demanded that the companies, quote, fundamentally restructure their operations, saying that this would require, among other things, a war on workers. Specifically, quote, workers who have already made painful concessions to make even more. Flanked by his new auto task force of Wall Street asset strippers, the very people responsible for the financing of Wall Street with the $11 trillion bailout. These are the very people who are going to attack workers' jobs, wages, and benefits. The auto task force concluded specifically that Chrysler could not survive without a partner and urged it to finalize a deal with the Italian automaker Fiat. For General Motors, the 101-year-old auto producer, internationally, one of the largest, it would be given, quote, a 60-day deadline to implement a very aggressive plan involving bigger concessions from the United Auto Workers Union, elimination of unprofitable brands and models, more factory closings, and a reduction of debt obligations to creditors and suppliers. What did this administration mean? What Obama said is that the bankruptcy would be a tool to make it easier for the companies to, quote, quickly clear away old debts that are weighing them down, end quote. And if they didn't restructure very soon, bankruptcy would be the option, and the courts would do what General Motors and the asset strippers hadn't been able to do. What Obama was referring to is the $20.4 billion that General Motors owes the United Auto Workers for funding a health welfare fund and $27 billion to unsecured obligations, primarily to large investment houses. Let's look at this auto task force before we discuss in detail the so-called path to viability of the Obama administration, the assault on auto workers. Ralph?
Maya, the task force that was assembled by Barack Obama essentially from the get-go made clear that it was proposing restructuring plans by General Motors and Chrysler, which would enable them to destroy the wages and benefits of auto workers and to breach all of the contracts pertaining to both wages, health care, and retirement. These are breaches which could only be achieved through the abrogation of obligation under the cover of a bankruptcy or Chapter 11 filing. And that is what Obama has been seeking. And it's interesting to observe here that the aim is not to save the auto companies in the sense of preventing mass layoffs or protecting the jobs and living standards of the auto workers or the millions more associated with the automobile industry. On the contrary, Obama selected specific spokespersons of the financial ruling class, notably former private equity investors and corporate asset strippers who have been experienced and associated with so-called restructurings in the past, notably the airline and steel industry, when they robbed tens of thousands of workers of jobs, wages, and pensions under a similar scenario.
The task force is headed by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, the key architect of the original Wall Street bailout under the Bush administration, who has laid out the plans for the further massive taxpayer-funded bailout of the banks. Sitting alongside Geithner is the National Economic Counselor Director, Lauren Summers, who, as Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton, pushed for the deregulation of the finance industry, that is, the elimination of the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act, and also for cuts in capital gains taxes. Both he and Geithner have repeatedly sought to limit the restrictions on executive pay for financial institutions involved in the federal bailout, such as that exposed at AIG. But most important are two key members of this task force: billionaire investor, Democratic Party fundraiser Stephen Ratner, and the asset stripper Ron Blum, who has been misnamed in much of the press as a friend of labor. Let's look at these two key people. Stephen Ratner, a man who has no experience in the auto industry. He originally was a business reporter for the New York Times, reporting on Wall Street and specifically the Chrysler bailout of 1980. After he worked for the New York Times, he left to work at Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley. He worked at those two investment houses for a number of years, but then achieved the number two spot, the deputy chief executive at the investment firm Lazard, Frere & Company, where he was an integral player in media mega deals, specifically the sale of Paramount Communications to Viacom. He left Lazard, Frere and co-founded a private equity firm, Quadrangle Group LLC, which so happens to manage New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's $13 billion-plus personal fortune and advises Bloomberg on his media empire. Ralph?
Amaya, let's be very specific about what we're describing here. The entire operation of this task force is to exploit the gain and to destroy the gains of generations of auto workers, because what they're after is to make the auto industry a lucrative investment for the same Wall Street financiers and bankers who have been profiteering out of this boondoggle derivative and financial paper shuffling crisis. Not only have they been bailed out with nearly $13 trillion, the number has risen now, but they are responsible for the original economic crisis, and now they are the master operators of this attack on the auto workers, and it is not merely intended to be an attack on the auto workers. It is the launching point for an offensive against the wages and conditions of the entire working class in the United States and internationally. It is very, very, very clear here what Obama is up to. They are going to take advantage of the crisis of the auto industry as it's described in order to compel the workers to abandon their union jobs, their wages, their pensions, their protections, all of the gains of the working class since the labor movement began. That is a measure of the magnitude of the crisis that capitalism is facing, that it is recklessly taking on working people on a scale of rapacity that has really no precedent in the history of the United States for the immediacy with which this assault is being prepared over the whole spectrum of economic life of working people in the United States.
And Ralph, these people have no sense of what it is to be part of the working class. Ratner is a man of immense fortune with multiple houses, including one that he is building, a 15,575 square foot house on the water in Martha's Vineyard, where he often pilots his private jet. His wife was referred to by New York Magazine as the DNC's ATM, because Ratner and his wife, Maureen White, have hosted many Democratic Party fundraisers at their lavish apartment on Fifth Avenue. The Times notes that while they were originally Hillary Clinton supporters, they then hosted events for Barack Obama after he sealed the nomination. So we have here the insiders of the Democratic Party, the super wealthy, including Summers, who received so much money from hedge funds and gets it over $67,000 for each speaking engagement. Ralph?
Well, it's not only a matter of their individual and personal wealth, which is a given. It's rather that they are literally the figures, not just spokespersons, but the actual members of the financial ruling class. Ratner's, quote, sprawling Manhattan apartment building is also the residence of his neighbor, the billionaire George Soros. They overlook Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He's on the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He has a horse farm in North Salem, New York, in northern Westchester County, near Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And not only does he have a 15,000-square-foot house on the water in Martha's Vineyard, but Ratner became the central figure in Democratic politics and the leading fundraiser for Gore, Kerry, Hillary Clinton, and later then Barack Obama. His wife is the former Democratic National Committee finance chairperson, as you mentioned, Maureen White. But the significance of this figure, Ratner, as the New York Times devotes a specific article to Obama's top auto industry troubleshooter, is that he is the most politically connected person in the banking industry. He is the very persona of the financial ruling class. And his colleague in this enterprise, Ron Blum, is Geithner's senior advisor. Now, Blum's importance stems from his origins as a Wall Street investor and in the restructuring of the U.S. steel industry. So you have here this pattern of these ruling class financial types. In the savings and loan scandal, they pull the same scam. Now, with respect to the restructuring of the steel industry, they did exactly what we're foreseeing here. Blum is praised, by the way, by the UAW as and in liberal publications such as The Nation as, quote, labor's man. Nothing so bespeaks the utter political degeneracy of the trade union bureaucracy and mouthpieces for the liberal establishments such as The Nation as to associate these hitmen for the American ruling class, the financial gangster bankers, as, quote, labor's men. Throughout his career, Mr. Blum has had nothing to do with the interests of working people. He made a huge fortune serving, by the way, the most privileged of the labor bureaucracy, protecting the income and privileges of the top union officials during each restructuring in which hundreds of thousands of workers were deprived of their jobs and pensions. Blum worked for the investment banker Lazar Frere, just as did Ratner, under the tutelage of the firm's senior partner Felix Rohatyn. It was Rohatyn who led the attack on New York City workers as chairman of the Municipal Assistance Corporation during the bankruptcy of New York City in the mid-1970s. It was indeed Rohatyn that advised Chrysler during the 1980 bailout and who was the architect of the destruction of thousands of jobs of auto workers of Chrysler at that time. Blum rose in prominence in this investment firm during a period when the union bureaucracy dropped any resistance to these government attacks orchestrated on behalf of the bosses, the financial architects of the current catastrophe, and aligned themselves with the campaign to drive down the living standards of U.S. workers on the rationale that this would enable them to compete with their counterparts in Japan and Europe. Manufacturing was systematically starved of investment. Vast profits were made through corporate takeovers and nothing but the crudest form of financial speculation that we've described so frequently in these past months on Taking Aim. This is indeed the feature of late capitalism, that productive forces are systematically destroyed. They are no longer interested in manufacture or in production because it doesn't generate the level of profit that will sustain capitalism. And they are fully committed to this boondoggle Ponzi scheme, deficit finance, derivative packaging of paper that they speculate upon without any collateral base, the very heart of the permanent and terminal crisis of the capitalist order. And faced with this crisis, what do? They deepen and extend the attack on working people, and as we will document in this show, with the active collusion of the privileged trade union bureaucracy, the syphilis of the working class movement in the United States.
Ralph, we need to look at two specific mechanisms of how the workers are ripped off and how the debts of the companies are then foisted on the workers. One is the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, and the other is the VEBA, the Voluntary Employees Beneficiary Association. And over the coming months, we're going to be talking more about these two mechanisms. The Employee Stock Ownership Plan was called a workers' buyout, so-called workers' buyout. And when Bloom was at Lazard Frere, he specialized in this scheme in which the pension funds of workers were raided in an effort to induce investors to take over failing companies. Specifically, Bloom was involved in two ESOP attempts in 1989. Some didn't work, and some did. There was the one at Eastern Airlines, which led to a bitter strike and an effort of the Airline Pilots Association to buy United Airlines. After the United deal first fell through, Bloom and another former partner at Lazard Frere's, Gene Kalin, set up an investment banking advisory boutique that advised unions on such deals. And for a fee of $22 million, they eventually succeeded in getting the United Pilots Union to craft an ESOP, a buyout of United Airlines, which was losing a lot of money. And they convinced the workers that this was the only way to save their jobs at United Airlines.
But what did it do?
It transferred the pensions of United Airlines, became debt. As the workers, they got 55% of the company's stock in exchange for $4.9 billion in wage and benefit concessions. And in the end, the rank-and-file workers lost everything because their stocks were wiped out when the company declared bankruptcy because it couldn't fulfill the requirements of the bankers. Look at what happened with these ESOPs. Failed attempts transferring the debt of these companies to the workers, and then the banks take over anyway.
Ralph? Well, I think what's important to understand here, brothers and sisters, is that this is the convergence of the privileged trade union bureaucracy and the bankers' instruments and agents themselves. When the union got 55% of company stock, as you indicated, was the trade-off for nearly $5 billion in wage and benefit concessions. So this is not a 55% stock ownership by the rank and file, but by the trade union bureaucracy, which becomes a partner of capital in a profiteering enterprise. When, indeed, Bloom left his firm, he became an advisor to the United Steelworkers Union bureaucrats. And, indeed, as the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported, Bloom became one of the principal architects of the restructuring of the steel industry, which followed the precise pattern. And indeed, as a Pittsburgh attorney and investment banker who knew Bloom for over 20 years said, he counseled the steelworkers' leadership to focus on making steelmakers profitable rather than on the number of jobs. So the consequence of this is exactly what you would expect. And indeed, as the Post-Gazette put it about Bloom, Ron understands that this will involve enormous pain. For who? For the workers. The United Steelworkers Union did much to stabilize the industry, as the Post-Gazette article describes it, by pushing for mergers among more than 80 steel companies, and the consequence was that they facilitated Wall Street sacrificing thousands of jobs and the destruction of the benefits for all retirees. The union bureaucrats then relaxed work rules so workers could be shifted from one role to another, and furthermore, they made a deal with management to increase the burden of pension and health care onto retirees.
Ralph, we have to look at how they specifically did that, because this is what is happening across the industries when they declare bankruptcy. It did. The steel industry set the pace. It then happened in coal, and it happened in with other manufacturers. The plan was the steel makers unloaded billions of dollars in pension obligations onto a new government pension benefit guarantee corporation, where they were sharply reduced. So this cut off more than 200,000 workers from what had been their guaranteed medical care, and it lowered their pensions. The union-backed concessions opened the door for, as I mentioned before, the other asset strippers to buy up failing companies, divest them of the successful parts of the company, and unload the failing parts, and then unload the pensions onto this government pension benefit guarantee corporation. Thousands of jobs were lost, and most of all, it raided the pensions of the workers who had worked long and hard for many years, built and anticipated retiring with pensions and medical care, which they then lost.
Let's look at this for a moment. What this union bureaucracy concession facilitated was opening the door for such as Wilbur Ross, the New York financier, who then took over LTV, Bethlehem, Weirton, and other old line companies and consolidated them into the International Steel Group. They slashed tens of thousands of jobs. After slashing the jobs and all the benefits, these 17 top companies reported a profit after taxes of $6.6 billion in 2004. Ross turned around and sold International Steel to an Indian entrepreneur, Lakshmi Mittal, for $4.5 billion in 2005, pocketing billions. He carried out similar raids in the auto parts and coal mining industry. He was the owner of Sago Mine, where 12 West Virginia miners were killed due to unsafe conditions. And he praised Bloom for his work with United Steelworkers, in which he said, "Unlike what a lot of people think about labor leaders, Bloom has a good understanding, an extremely good understanding of the economics of business." Indeed, he added, Bloom and these union leaders convinced the workers of the need to make concessions quickly to make the business work. And Bloom stated to the steel industry conference in 2004, the best route for creating and sustaining viable companies was a partnership between labor and providers of capital. We recognize in a capitalist society, if capital does not earn the return, it'll stop showing up. Bloom helped negotiate the setting up of the Voluntary Employees Beneficiary Association, the VEBA you described, to relieve these companies of Ross of all their obligations for retiree health care benefits. They then repeated this deal with Goodyear Tire and Rubber, and they set up a VEBA fund to take over the retiree health care, thereby enabling Goodyear to remove $1.2 billion of liability from its balance sheet and absolve it of any responsibility any longer for the health care program of their workers.
And, Ralph, this is what Lazard Frere, Lazard Limited, as it was later called, was hired by the United Auto Workers Union to review General Motors finances. Again, this is what was set up, the VEBA, with a $20.4 billion health welfare fund, making the auto workers responsible for the retirees fund. It's important to look at the United Auto Workers, which in the 1970s had 1.5 million members, working members, now reduced to 512,000, with a million retirees. This is what's happened with the auto industry here in the United States, because the new companies coming in, developing, the foreign automakers do not have unionized workers. So the United Auto Workers has become a big retirees fund. Companies like General Motors and Ford and Chrysler would pay out the health care benefits and pensions for the United Auto Workers. And so what GM did is shift the responsibility of this $20.4 billion health benefit fund to the United Auto Workers. But General Motors was supposed to fund it. And now this is what is under discussion with the Obama administration, which wants to make sure that General Motors, which doesn't have the cash to fund it, is going to rip off the United Auto Workers retirees.
It's not the first time. In 2005, Lazar Frere Limited was hired by the bureaucrats at the United Auto Workers to review GM's finances, specifically to reduce the health care payments thereof. Paul Krell of the UAW told Reuters at the time that Bloom was involved to help the union review GM finances, and the Goodyear plan became the model for the retiree health fund negotiated by the UAW bureaucracy in 2007, another scheme in which the workers were stuck with worthless stock with drastic reduction in health care benefits. So Bloom and Ratner and Geithner and Summers are now placed in charge by Obama of the restructuring of the U.S. auto industry. That means specifically the most brutal attacks on workers, attacks that cannot be resisted by anybody but the rank and file. It means mobilizing auto workers independently of the UAW leadership, the bureaucracy, in a political struggle with the ruling class, with the Obama administration, with the financial elite that controls it. There is no alternative for working people, as we will begin to demonstrate here as we review not merely the assault, but the role of the trade union bureaucracy in facilitating it. Maya, the declaration by Obama that he was going to issue a set of ultimatums to General Motors and Chrysler representing the supposed intervention of the U.S. government is effectively designed to do what we have been describing, impose a brutal restructuring of the American auto industry to the exclusive benefit and interest of the financial speculators of Wall Street. The measures demanded by Obama included the elimination of Chrysler as an independent company, as you had indicated, by merger with Fiat, or outright liquidation, the downsizing of General Motors, the massive destruction of the benefits and the health care entitlements and the wage contracts of the workers in the union, and at the heart of what was called a new path to viability, which was outlined by the auto task force that we've described up to now, is, quote, the aggressive shutting of plants, the elimination of models, the closing of dealerships, the destruction of jobs, deeper cuts in wages, benefits, and work rules, and the elimination of the auto company's pension and retiree health care obligations. In our face, brothers and sisters, brazen, open declaration of all-out war on working people on a scale that has not happened since the founding of the CIO in the 1930s. Obama announced that his auto industry task force had rejected the restructuring plans submitted by GM and Chrysler, required under the terms of the $17.4 billion loans granted by the Treasury under Bush and his TARP, the Troubled Asset Release Program. Under TARP, by the way, hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer money were handed over to the banks and to the insurance giant American International Group with no strings attached. No Wall Street bankers were removed from their posts, even though Citigroup and Bank of America each received $45 billion in TARP funds plus $300 billion in government guarantees for their own bad debts. I mean, there is no limit to the rapacity of these banker gangsters and their mouthpieces in office, such as Barack Obama.
Ralph, I think it's important for our brothers and sisters listening to this program to go to the internet and take down the Obama administration new path to viability for GM and Chrysler, which is available for everyone to read, because it is classic. It really shows where Barack Obama is when it comes to the interest of working people, because it says right here in clear wording that his goal is to save Wall Street and to attack the workers. Let's look at the first paragraph where they say it's an effort to move towards energy independence, but only in the context of a, quote, fundamental restructuring that will allow these companies to prosper without taxpayer support. But as Ralph has mentioned, that taxpayer support has bailed out Wall Street to trillions of dollars. As well, there are so many industries, such as the vast war machine, that are subsidized, as well as the big agribusiness companies. This is loading the taxpayers with the bailout of Wall Street and gutting 60 years of worker struggle. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama intensifies the war on auto workers. Let's look specifically at some of this wording in this so-called new path to viability. When they talk about, quote, unsustainable liabilities and the fact that they have to, quote, clear away old liabilities so they can get on a path to success while they keep making cars and providing jobs in our economy. What do they mean by these old liabilities? As I mentioned, the primary old liability is the pension and health benefits of the auto worker retirees. Money that should have been paid into the fund all along, the pension fund, but the government didn't insist on the full funding of the auto industry pension funds. An important article by Stephen Lindemann that appeared in Mahatma makes a record of the 60 years of gains of workers' movement that will be gone with the Obama restructuring. This includes permanent job losses, lower wages, gutted work rules, including health and safety protection on the job, forfeited security through lost benefits and pensions, specifically for retirees, on top of everything that was given up in the 2007 negotiations when the UAW surrendered to management and muscled the rank and file to go along, and the sacrifices that the workers made with the Bush $25 billion bailout. This included a ban on GM and Chrysler strikes, effectively meaning more wage and benefit cuts because they had no bargaining power then with their no more threat of strike, ending the UAW's jobs bank that provided help to furloughed workers because there is seasonal work, and when workers get furloughed, the jobs bank helps find other jobs. Then let's look what it's also going to mean. Further plant closures with these permanent job loss. For GM alone, it's 85% fewer production jobs in 1990. Think about that. That's only 19 years. And all these jobs have been offshored by the companies such as GM, which is building plants in Mexico and China and elsewhere. And for new hires, the new hires, according to the concessions made by the unions, don't have a regular defined pension plan, but instead have 401k arrangements, which collapse with the collapse of the stock market. And this replaced the former defined pensions. In the new 401k, the company gives $1 in company stock for each hour worked. That is worthless when the company heads for bankruptcy. The major health care concessions with the union-run VEBA, that's Voluntary Employee Beneficiary Association, now puts the UAW, which is supposed to be defending the workers, in the health care business. The employee buyouts, you recall, all the tens of thousands of people who were forced into early retirement. And as I mentioned before, the UAW lost the representation with the loss of 1 million jobs between 1979 and 2007, from 1.5 million down to 512,000. And that was in 207. By the end of 2008, their membership dropped even further to 431,000. Ralph?
In that formal government declaration on the part of Obama's administration as to what they plan to do, here are the specifics that are set forth with no window dressing or even attempts to conceal the intent. One, Fiat, Chrysler, and all Chrysler stakeholders must clearly understand that significant hurdles must be cleared. Chrysler must restructure its balance sheet so it has a sustainable debt burden. This means extinguishing the vast majority of Chrysler's outstanding secured debt all of its unsecured debt and equity, other than trade creditors providing normal trade terms. That translates into greater concessions from the United Auto Workers than those outlined in any existing loan agreements. They have to be clearly designating the pensions, health care obligations, and wage commitments of the company as sacrificed on the altar of viability. Chrysler needs, and this is key to this specific open declaration, Chrysler needs a credible plan to execute this the restructuring. Given the magnitude of the concessions needed, the most effective way for Chrysler to emerge from this restructuring will be with a fresh start, will be by using an expedited bankruptcy process as the tool to extinguish liabilities. Know what that means? Under bankruptcy, the courts can cancel all contractual obligations of the company to the workers, that namely every wage increase, every job protection, every union contract, every pension fund, every health care plan can be wiped out by decree under the aegis of bankruptcy, whereby the workers it's not a question of negotiating, it's not a question of any kind of formal arrangements, they just wipe them out. This is a most unprecedented, brazen attack on the living standards and the survivability of the workers in the United States. What we had in the general strike in San Francisco in 1934 was a bitter, all-out struggle to overcome this reign of terror that was waged against working people, where their union jobs meant nothing, where they showed up for work, and if they didn't submit to a competition for the lowest wage, they were blackballed or they were beaten to a pulp. This is what we are returning to on a scale that dwarfs what was occurring in the 1930s. And I think we need to look at the role of the UAW bureaucracy in engineering this together with the financial gangsters in charge of the Obama administration.
Go ahead, Ralph.
It's been well over a week and a half since Barack Obama refused to restructure General Motors and Chrysler without drastic, painful concessions on the auto workers. The top executives at the two companies immediately agreed to accelerate plans to close more factories, lay off tens of thousands of workers, and impose deep wage and benefit cuts on the workers and retirees. And indeed, as the GM interim CEO Fritz Henderson said, if this isn't achieved through negotiations, we'll do it through the bankruptcy courts. In the face of this, the organization, namely the UAW, that claims to represent 90,000 unionized workers and 1 million retirees at General Motors and Chrysler's, said nothing, not a mumbling word. UAW President Ronald Gettelfinger did not speak a single word of objection, nor has any public statement on the union website challenged this open declaration of a plan to abrogate all the obligations and contracts and guarantees and protections and wage agreements and health care agreements and pension fund agreements and job protection agreements that have characterized the working class in its efforts to sustain a viable life over decades. Asked why, a UAW spokesperson said, the union has chosen not to issue any statement. Now, the significance of the silence is very clear. The bureaucracy of the UAW is again conspiring behind the backs of the rank and file to impose the same massive concessions on auto workers that were inflicted on the workers in the steel industry and on the airline industry and on the savings and loan industry in the outcome of that scandal. In reality, this bureaucracy feels nothing but contempt for their own members and keeps them in the dark, even as the government of Obama, at the behest of the financial aristocracy, is going to strip workers of their livelihoods and wipe out communities across the United States. Nothing but acquiescence. When you examine the lack of response by the UAW, Reuters commented as follows. Auto analysts see the union as shell-shocked by the hard line taken by Obama. who won huge support from the UAW and other unions in last elections. Nothing underscores, by the way, the utter stupidity of the UAW bureaucracy in entertaining such illusions about the Democratic Party and Obama, which has done this now for decades. What did it expect from a president who handed $13 trillion to Wall Street banks, handed control of the auto industry to a task force made up of private equity and hedge fund managers who had engineered the banking crisis in the first place? This is not a question of mistaken policies or politics. This alliance with the Democratic Party on the part of the trade union bureaucracy is essentially a collusion in subordinating the working class to the capitalist order. The bureaucracy is fundamentally antagonistic to the needs of the rank and file. Every time there's been an advance in the struggle on the part of working people at the time of the Great Depression with the formation of the CIO, it has required overcoming the restrictions of a class collusion bureaucracy with the capitalist order that they serve as what Lenin called the labor lieutenants of the ruling class.
Ralph, let's look at some of the concessions and what it again means, not just for the auto workers, but what it means for workers throughout the United States. As I've mentioned in prior shows, the organizing strength and the bargaining strength of the United Auto Workers in that they usually had industry-wide negotiations with the major automakers, the big three. What was established for one automaker went on for all the others. And that was the classic of organizing because it set the pace for workers throughout the United States, with the unionized workers of the United Auto Workers leading the way. With the concessions, workers throughout the United States losing the 8-hour day, the living wage, generous increases, good benefits, pensions. This is very important. Let's look at what the New York Times said on April 1st. Its headline, Workers Share in the Pressure on Car Makers. It reveals they're bearing the brunt of it. As the New York Times writes, the writers Micheline Maynard and Stephen Greenhouse, quote, there is virtually no chance that the companies can make the necessary cuts without the UAW's surrendering some hard-won benefits for its members. And they look at some of the concessions that were made at Ford, which is not under attack at the moment from the Obama administration because of all the vast concessions that the UAW made at Ford already. Losing bonuses that had been part of the contract, the fact that overtime occurs not after an 8-hour day, but only after working 40 hours in a week, which means you can work 10 and 12 hours in a day and not get overtime. This is only the beginning of some of the concessions that were made at Ford. The New York Times quotes some of the auto workers themselves. Brett Ward, who spent 15 years at Chrysler, said he was disheartened by the idea of more cuts. The union, he said, quote, told us in our last contract that this is what we had to do to make the company viable. 2 years later, they want to go in and carve it like a turkey. Russ Gregg, another longtime worker at GM, he had retired after 40 years at General Motors. He said the prospect of bankruptcy couldn't come at a worse time. He had helped build the prototype models of a future GM vehicles, and now he's worried about even getting his pension after 40 years at General Motors. 40 years of profits for General Motors shareholders, 40 years of large executive pay, and now Russ Gregg has to wonder how he's going to live. He said, quote, they could end up taking a big chunk. The company would return, but not before a lot of lives are devastated. Ralph?
The UAW and other major unions and their trade union bureaucracy have abandoned long ago any resistance to the bosses and the employers in the name of labor management partnerships, and they've suppressed every struggle against plant closing, mass layoffs, and concessions. What is the consequence? Dues-paying members fell from a peak of 1.5 million in 1979 to 431,000, the lowest level since World War II. The rank and file are alienated, disgusted, and completely deprived of any confidence in the bureaucracies representing their interests. The bureaucracy of these trade unions, which has a privilege that represents something like a 13-to-1 ratio of their own income compared to the workers they supposedly represent, has therefore sought other sources of income to protect its privilege. That's the significance of the transformational contract that the UAW bureaucracy signed in 2007, handing over control of a multi-billion-dollar retiree health care trust fund in exchange for cutting the wages of new employees in half. That was a deal made in consultation with who? The Wall Street investment firm of Lazar Frere. The very operation of Ratner and Bloom and these other instruments like Geithner and Summers of the banking elite, who are Obama's hitmen in this entire process. The UAW leadership sought to transform itself into a profit-making business, and it is currently in intense negotiations with the White House and the auto companies and the big investors about how to secure its private interests in carving up the auto industry. So, as Business Week reports, the government wants the UAW to accept over half of the $20 billion owed to its retiree health care fund in stock. The administration wants the UAW to accept an entirely new contract which slashes medical benefits, reduces current workers' wages to the level of non-union workers at Japanese-owned plants. And what will the UAW become? One of the biggest shareholders in the new company, the bureaucracy will. Business Week said, while GM shares trade at just $2 now, management has made the case that with less debt, it will be worth far more. In other words, the union functionaries will make millions as junior partners in the exploitation of their own members. That's their role. That's their class role. That's their political role. And that's the function they serve in facilitating this outright rapine destruction of the working class in the auto industry in the United States.
Ralph, let's go again to the New York Times, which on March 31st had an article by Bill Vlasic and Nick Bunkley. The U.S. sees a smaller future for GM than GM does. In this article, they refer to the fact that GM has been making deep cuts in recent years and exacting concessions, as you rightly say, from the United Auto Workers, closing plants, shedding tens of thousands of jobs. But what they don't say is that they're shedding these jobs in the United States, and they've been opening up and building their plants in India, China, and now the parts industry in Mexico. Mexico has become the largest parts supplier for the auto industry, as opposed to the companies manufacturing the parts here in the United States. And in this article, it talks about far more jobs will be shed. Another 47,000 was proposed in the plans that it submitted to the government last month, and which Barack Obama and his Wall Street task force said is not enough. GM had proposed cutting its brands from 8 down to 4 in the United States, and it may be left only with Chevrolet and Cadillac, and its huge European business would be jettisoned also. What we're talking about with the asset strippers is very important to look at, because General Motors, as many of the companies at the time of the big corporate buyouts with the, if you recall, Michael Milliken and the huge junk bond collection, the speculation of creating junk bonds, buying up companies, stripping them. And this is what we have with General Motors and the new asset strippers, looking at it as a collection of assets, of factories, research centers, distribution networks. Despite having cut more than 100,000 jobs in the United States since 2005, GM is out to cut even more. That's what we've seen at General Motors. Ralph?
The New York Times on the 9th of April spelled out what we're looking at here. New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has charged J. Ezra Merkin, the multibillionaire hedge fund manager, and the chairman of GMAC Financial Services, the financial arm of General Motors, colluder with the government in these scams and schemes against the workers in conjunction with this trade union bureaucracy. He has now been formally charged with bilking investors out of $2.4 billion by funneling their money without their knowledge to who? Convicted Ponzi scheme operator Bernard Madoff. According to the complaint filed by Cuomo with the New York Supreme Court, Merkin was granted $470 million in personal incentive fees by claiming to be carefully managing the money his clients were investing in three hedge funds while funneling the money to Madoff's operation. Out of Merkin's funds, Ascart Partners LP, from its inception in 1952, was described as, quote, a feeder fund for Madoff, reporting assets of $1.8 billion in December of 2008, when Madoff had confessed to authorities that he had been running the world's biggest pyramid scheme. Why Ascart was wiped out, along with hundreds of millions of dollars in two other Merkin funds invested heavily with Madoff. Merkin was known as a savvy Wall Street insider, philanthropist, and a pillar of New York's social and cultural establishment, as well as being the head of GMAC's financial services. He's now been charged with, quote, engaging in a panoply of lies to dupe hundreds of clients, including nonprofit organizations and charities. Here it comes full circle. Madoff was investigated 9 times. And all that time, these investigations by the SEC were suppressed. He was none other than the head of NASDAQ, Mr. Madoff, in collusion with his partners in crime, J. Ezra Merkin, the chairman of GMAC. This Morgan Stanley, by the way, was the facilitator of all this, referring to the bank as Ascott's principal prime broker. This is the criminalization of the American ruling class, sanctioned by the authorities now of Obama, and setting up a structure for the destruction of workers' gains, peopled by these very criminals and gangsters.
And Ralph, one thing we should look at, there is a myth that the American auto companies, Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors, are producing cars at a higher cost than the foreign auto makers now producing in the United States, specifically the Japanese companies like Nissan, Honda, Toyota. A study that was done in 1992 and reported by the New York Times back then showed that the efficiency of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors was they were as efficient as the Japanese companies. And even in recent articles in the New York Times, it showed that the cost difference between American production and these foreign producers in the United States is negligible. The big difference is that these companies do not have the pension and health benefits that the American companies have, that GM and Ford and Chrysler have, are longstanding. General Motors is 101 years old, and they have the pension liabilities and particularly the health benefit liabilities attached to these companies, and that the foreign automakers do not have. The other difference, the difference in the wage structure of union and non-union doesn't add very much to the cost of producing the car. So this is a false issue, but the Obama administration is using this to destroy 60 years of hard-won gains of the workers' movement, and destroy the gains in the auto industry will destroy the gains of workers throughout the United States. We need to summarize now. I go to you, Ralph, to summarize. And we will continue this discussion in the weeks to come. Ralph?
I'll just make reference, Maya, to an important article by Carl Bronski on 10th of April about Ontario, Canada, where the Ontario Premier, Dalton McGuinty, stated that General Motors or Chrysler, when they declare bankruptcy, will be the trigger for the Liberal government of Canada to cancel all pensions, and tens of thousands of retired auto workers will be denied the pensions on which they have depended and for which they've worked all their lives, and they will be faced faced with total impoverishment. The enormity of this declaration, a formal declaration by the Canadian government, can be measured by the destruction of the survivability of working people in the auto industry. This is an assault on working people which cannot be met by temporizing, by extending time, by attempting to pressure the government or by seeking to obtain a better deal from them. This is a criminal ruling class with a system in terminal decay. It will not be overcome by pleading. It is another order of resistance that is required here, and we will begin to spell this out in the weeks to come.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama Intensifies the War on Auto Workers. We'll be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.